Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Your ultimate culinary companion.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
So, welcome to another edition of Dishing It Out with me, Gareth Mullins.
And Gary O'Hanlon.
And this week we're going to talk about something that I look forward to every time of year, and we're going to be talking about St. Patrick's Day and all the things that go on in our professional kitchens around this time of year.
Paddy's Day,
yeah, good bit of that. And also then we're going to probably drift in and elve a little bit about what food we like to cook at this time of year. I mean, it's an interesting time of year because spring is about to start and you're kind of coming to the end of your winter vegetables, and yeah, there's still a bit of winter cooking that's going on. So we're actually going to try and share a few recipes with you today. So we're getting lots of positive feedback about that. So you'll have to be just listening to me and Gary today, no guests. So yeah, buckle up, get ready.
Okay, it is ingredient of the week time. Big man's going to go first. Gareth, what have you for us?
So I was a little bit torn, but it's alcohol is what the ingredient is. And I think it's like what home cooks probably sometimes neglect. So I use a lot of beer in cookery, which is in my professional life, I probably don't use it as much. I use wine. It's either red wine or white wine. Gary, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. So most sauces, when you add a wine to a sauce, it gives you levels of acidity and it gives you balance, but it also gives you loads of flavour. But when I'm at home, I don't always have a bottle of wine open, so I like to use beer. I shared a chili recipe a couple of weeks ago, and I deglazed the pan with some beer. And it's what I'd like people to think about is, like, think about all the flavour that's in beer, be it Guinness, be it lager, be it even cider. Like, it's injecting flavour into whatever you're cooking. So obviously you're not going to be pouring it in on top of your cornflakes or anything, or maybe you will depending on what the weekend's like. But if you're making something like a chilli, like I said, and you caramelise your mince and all those little bits get stuck to the bottom of the pan, some people, if you don't understand what's going on, you might be nervous about that. But what that actually is pure caramelisation, pure flavour, and there's a technique in our world called deglazing. And what it just means is where you add a liquor, either normally wine, in on top of a roasting tray or in on top of a pot.
Yeah.
And it takes all those little bits off.
And a little trick on that is try and have that liquid as cold as possible.
Yeah, exactly.
Because the shock factor when it hits the base of the pan, the colder it is and it reacts with that, obviously that hot pot or pan, it creates even more, like you'll pull the sediment up quicker.
Exactly.
With a really cold one, yeah.
Yeah, but it's what gives a sauce depth and flavour and body. It even helps thicken it up. So it's those little caramelised pieces that I think it's probably the one thing when you speak to someone that's only starting to get into cooking, it's probably the one thing they don't boil into early on.
Well, when you think about it, like if you ever see any chef on TV or any cooks on the telly, or they're chatting about, you know, at Christmas especially, like a lot of people that maybe wouldn't cook all through the year, Gareth, you'll see a lot of them deglazing the roasting tray and take. So basically, if anything is stuck to the pan, pot, or roasting tray, that is the most flavoursome part of what's just being cooked.
Big time.
And the deglazing, as Gareth is explaining there, is now reincorporating that, whether it's back into the main dish or, in this instance, back into a gravy or a sauce.
Yeah, so that's my one. Probably not a stereotypical ingredient that you might think about, but a super, super important. And again, I will say to you, think about that base alcohol. When you reduce it down, so when you get it to come down, the flavour that's in there will intensify.
Mm.
So that's really
And also important to know the alcohol burns
off. Yeah, burns off. Yeah, don't be so worrying about giving it to your kids.
Nobody has to worry about giving it to the weekend.
I mean, I suppose another amazing example of using alcohol is if you use brandy making a pepper sauce.
Mm-hmm.
So the only thing I would say, if you're doing any liquor where it has a high alcohol content and you're cooking on gas, it's obviously going to flambe or go on fire. So if you're nervous about that in any way, I would say turn the gas off, add the liquor in. The pan is going to be really hot. It'll bubble away, and then just put the pan back on super low. You don't have to flambe things. It's just a little bit of a, it's just, it makes it burn off a bit quicker. That's why chefs do it, and it looks good if you're doing it in a room or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's what I'm going with this week. So, Gar, what are you going with?
I'm going to go with a bell pepper, but in particular, red bell peppers. I think there's something that what you always see on shop shelves is an indication of what sells. And in Ireland, even back in the days, you know, I moved to Boston in 1999 and came back in 2005. And if somebody says to me, you know, the progression of Irish food, I would always say, well, the quickest way to explain it is whenever I left in 99, it was turnips, celery, carrots, onions and leeks. And when I came back in 2005, literally, you're now seeing everything from beetroots, aubergines, pimentos, courgettes, squashes, pumpkins, you name it, it's there in all of them now. You know what I mean? But a bell pepper is something, obviously, that a lot of Irish are eating. My kids absolutely love them. They don't like them cooked. They love them raw. I mean, they will eat red pepper sticks quicker than even a bar of chocolate. And that's saying something about my wee dudes. Anytime I've got peppers up on the chopping board, it's just a natural thing that I do now. I just have a wee thing at the side because I like all the wee dices. Even at home, it's kind of the OCD. The top and the tail, I'll cut them into little strips for Cora and Ollie, usually Ollie, put them aside. And then I just like to dice up nice and neat the heart of it, you know.
But I'll let you give out to you if the pepper's a little not perfectly diced.
I'm terrified in Eddie, yeah. You never know when the next clip of the year is coming.
Maybe you didn't square that pepper before you diced it.
You can smell her coming from around the corner, you know. Yeah, your julienne's all over the shop, man. Put yourself together. Lose some weight. You know what I mean? But, so they're just so versatile, you know, whether it's raw in a salad, whether it's caramelized and in a salad, which is beautiful as well. It brings a whole new texture when it's cooked and cooked down slow. Fire roasted, obviously.
It's my favorite way to have them is burning the skins off.
Yeah, the burning the skin. I have a gas cooker. You just literally, as it says, you put the dry bell pepper right on the gas, sitting literally on the flame, and you burn it till it's completely black into a bowl. Immediately get some cling film over the top of the bowl. Leave it for about 25 minutes. The steam is going to now start to work, and it's going to get in underneath that charred skin. And then pull off the cling film, and then you're basically almost going to be able to just going to wipe off the skin then, and then pull out the seeds of the heart, and then you can set them aside. What's really nice then actually is to get a little bit of crushed garlic confit on top, say like for one clove of garlic, pair one bell pepper, one teaspoon of chopped oregano for each bell pepper, and then olive oil. And that's a marinated red pepper. And then over this course of a week, you can use that in a mortadella sandwich or a ham sandwich or in a salad. Absolutely stunning. And again, you can puree it up. You can use it as a little sauce on fish or whatever. You can do a red pepper coulis is really, really nice. They're just so versatile. Obviously, stir fries, curries, you name it, a bell pepper is your man, yeah, for the job. So that's what I'm going with this week.
Lovely. So, guys, Paddy's Day. What does Paddy's Day mean to you as a chef? Going out and drinking loads of dirty pints, or is it filled, or what is it?
Well, I'll tell you what, the very last thing I do is probably one of the few days of the year I don't drink. I rarely go to pubs anyway, you know what I mean? I like a wee scoop at home. But Paddy's Day to me was bizarre day at home in Ermelton. I absolutely loved Paddy's Day at home, like whether it was the church or what, I don't know. But there used to be like this big event on St. Patrick's Day in Ermelton.
The parade,
we called it the bizarre day. Yeah, well, no, it was the hall, the local community centre. Like, there'd be loads of games, there'd be loads of food stalls, loads of different competitions going on. Yeah, it was one of those days. Like we have a thing called the River Lennon, which is a really famous salmon river that goes through my hometown. But Paddy's, so you'd have a big parade on that day. I mean, I love machines. You don't have to ask an Ed. I'm always trying to buy tractors and motorbikes and shit that we shouldn't really be spending our money on. But I'd buy them and then say sorry, you know what I mean? So, but on Paddy's Day back then, like, there would be parades as well. But the Bizarre Day, and then the Lennon Festival would have a big
everyone
parade.
That was known as the Bizarre Day.
Yeah,
or was that your
bizarre
name?
Day. No, Bizarre Day. Yeah, that's what we called it. Yeah, because it was this big bazaar. Basically, just that was it that went on in the town. And there'd be loads of prizes, loads of stuff, and all the boys our age, like, we'd be there mucking about outside, chasing around the town. It was just a day filled with absolute crack. in Ramelton, and it was nothing to do with alcohol, absolutely nothing to do with pubs or anything like that at all. It was just...
I thought you were going to tell us just dyed the river green. That's right.
No, no. As the years went on, obviously, and I moved to Boston then, and I always remember one of the first things a chef said to me in my first kitchen in Boston was like, oh, great, we have a patty here now, like, he'll look after the corned beef and cabbage. And I goes, what are you on about, sir? Corned beef and cabbage. It goes, corned beef to me, you got in Worski's in town and it was sliced and you put it into a sandwich. You know, I know now, and I've cooked it now, and I could cook it really, really nice. But over there, they just literally boiled the brisket, you know what I mean? And you have the red corned beef, you have the grey corned beef, one cured, one not cured. And that's a real...
One dry cured and one wet cured. Is that the difference?
Yeah, I don't know what the difference is in the cure. Like, or maybe nitrates is used in one and they're not used in the other as well, you know. But, you know, I do a lovely whole grain mustard glazed...
brisket.
Brisket now, you know, and it's really, really nice. But honest to God, they were all amazed. I mean, boiled bacon and cabbage, yeah. I mean, as a chef, I get kind of protective of Ireland, and it really, really bugs me. And people go on about, oh, the Irish are famous for boiled beef and cabbage and shepherd's pie. I mean, the Irish bar has an awful lot to answer for across the world for tainting his way. That's our level, you know what I mean?
But is it not fair to say at one point in Ireland that really was what was going on? Like, you know, I mean...
Yeah,
I know food has come an awful long way since then, and like, I kind of hate to hear anybody dishing bacon and cabbage, because bacon and cabbage make it has to be up there one of the best things you can eat.
I do a bacon and cabbage terrine, right, with a white wine, a Chardonnay leek cream finished then in chives. You know, it would have been a dish we did in the Old Post, but that in turn was a Kevin Thornton variation on a dish. Like, so it's a really, really beautiful terrain that's just, you know, it's served warm, you know what I mean? You cut it. There's a huge amount of work into it. You know, you have your ham hocks that are boiled, and then you have the cabbage that you cook in that ham water, that ham stock. So it's catching a wee bit of the gelatinous that's coming out of that marrow that's in the bone. And then you're cling wrapping a loaf tin. You're adding in the cabbage for your top layer. Then you got to put in the chunks of the ham hock, making sure that there's no fat, obviously no gristle, because that'll ruin your terrine, as you know, Gareth. But also putting them in that they're in chunks, that when the terrine is cut, you're seeing through them. Another layer of cabbage and then ham hock, and so on. And then you got to get it that it's protruding outside of the loaf tin by about 2.5 to 3 inches. Wrap over your cling again, get a lot of weight on it, leave it overnight, unwrap it, tidy up the trim, slice it into a little flat under a salamander to get a wee bit of heat into it, and still lifting it up onto that Chardonnay leek cream without breaking it, keeping it all together. And that is elegance personified. And that's bacon and cabbage in my world, and probably your world as well. But equally at home, a load of mashed buds, lock of scallions in there, or raw onions, the way the old boy would eat them. Parsley sauce as thick as me cell. Some peppery, crushed turnip. Oh, man, get he up.
And come here, what cut of bacon?
For me, I like the collar, you know what I mean? Like the collar.
Has to be the collar.
Yeah, the collar of bacon's really, really nice, you know what I mean? When it comes
to
dinner.
Like, I mean, loin of bacon, honey glazed, is a delicious thing. But it is nice, but yeah. It's nice, right? And if you have people that aren't mad about the fat, I mean, I'm looking for the fat when I'm eating something like that.
Yeah.
There is people that like it lean. What about you now?
Lean.
Oh, there you see.
Oh,
there
Ed you. Chef.
Oh, Ed Chef has spoken.
Ed Chef has piped up here. Man's on a mission. He's lost a bit of weight. He's eating no more bacon fat. The crack has completely gone out of
Jack
his life.
Jack Spratt over here.
Yeah. Yeah, collar's really nice. You know what I mean? Well, the thing is, a bit of loin of bacon, I think you maybe eat more loin of bacon throughout the year as well, just because it's a wee bit quicker to cook, you know?
What I like about Paddy's Day, when I think about it across my lifespan, it's changed with...
Aye.
Obviously, I'd lived in different parts of the world, so... But when I was a kid, similar to you, we used to go into town. Obviously, I'm in Dublin, we went into the big parade.
Yeah.
That was a thing when you hit about 13 or 14, maybe, I was kind of doing that. And then I went, when I qualified, so I think it was 21 or 20, I moved out to Australia. And Paddy's Day was on wheels. Like, it was literally
a much bigger day. It was outside very of Ireland.
Yeah. But it was nearly like there was an Ireland football match or something on. Yeah, like, you know, but back in the good old days, like, it was brilliant, man. Yeah, brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And you'd be out listening to all the blade and diddly music and trying to find yourself a bacon and cabbage somewhere.
I mean, you probably felt this in Australia. You feel more Irish in Australia than you probably ever did here, did you?
Yeah, but you know what I also liked over there as well? Like, all your other pals, like, so, you know, French and Scottish and English and all. Everybody was playing Irish. It was deadly, right?
Everyone gets into it.
And it was never a really big thing for me in work because I always had to have the day off.
Yeah.
But then when I come home, then... when I got back into hotels, like it nearly became like a week long or even a month long thing. So,
it's a huge tourist attraction.
But
for
like you know, the amenities that we put into the bedrooms all turn into shamrocks and pots of gold, and what we serve in the bar are all little shamrock cookies. Yeah. And we really try and personify
that's
that.
Nice.
Yeah, it's lovely, right? And then, obviously, when your kids, my kids came along, then. At the start, when they were younger, we used to bring them into town. But then, as they got a little bit older, like there's a local parade in Swords that I love going down to because I walk in it nearly every year because kids' football teams are in it. And so, like, I like the way Paddy's Day has changed for me. But at the centre of it all, it's just about hanging out with your friends, and, you know, having a good time. I mean, that moves into hanging out with your family and. You
so when I left America, I started going back then on a holiday. It was usually around March. It was a good time as a chef. Like I used to kind of nearly always take a week off on my own around that time. And that being a teacher, I wouldn't always be able to take the time off in the summers and stuff that got there. So March Madness is a big thing. All my buddies over in between New Jersey, New York and Boston, I'd fly into Boston for a couple of days and then we would red-eye it to Vegas or Atlantic City, but generally Vegas. And we'd party for about 3 days in Vegas and then finish up in New York or Boston and back home, you know. But one year, we all went over him.
Look at that devilment look across up, his face.
We ended up partying.
Something's coming.
We ended up back from Vietnam.
Yeah.
we ended up partying at Paris. And anyways, we were there and... This big dude came rolling over to us, ready, had the big green glasses on. It was
Paddy's Day.
Are you going
to tell a story about battering somebody?
Yeah, no. And because it was March or whatever, that's when March Madness is actually on and the boys can gamble. And like there used to be no gambling at all anywhere in America. So the college basketball month, like to give you a perspective, the March is the best month of the year to go to Vegas. It is the sports bars are absolutely jammed. The biggest games in college sport are happening day and night. And this dude came rolling down and goes, oh my God, he heard one of us chatting and he goes, you're Irish. And he came over and he started crying and goes, I just won $85,000. And I was like, what? He says, I got up out of bed. I went to go to the toilet. My wife was in the toilet. I was like, oh, I got to go to the toilet. You know what I mean? I've been in the beer all day the day before. He goes downstairs into the lobby, goes to the Jacks. And like, if you've ever been to Vegas, there's a slot or a one-arm bandit everywhere. He's coming, walking out of the toilet. There's a one-arm bandit right in front of his face.
Never
he puts his hand into his big Bermuda shorts and he had $5, just a loose fiver, in his pocket. He sticks it in, bang, ding, 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 ding. But he looks up, right, and it says $1,000. Everybody goes, oh my God, I've won $1,000. And there's a thing called the progressive, apparently. It's a numbers going up and up and up all the time. Next thing, the manager's landed, everybody's standing landing around him celebrating. He's like, oh, this is great. I got $1,000. He goes, no, no, what are you talking about? You just won $85,000. Wow. And that was St. Patrick's Day, like about 10 years ago, whatever it was. He's like, what? He goes, you've won 80. And he was a construction worker. He had two kids going to college. One in college, one going to college that year. And he came over to us. And I just always remember him being the nicest dude and the happiest. And that was
boy a lot of gargle. What did he
and
do?
And he fucking bought. He, like, we were all, but you know, Irish, we don't like, everybody likes their chipping in proper patties. Yeah, we let him buy one round and he stayed with us the whole day, man. And his wife joined us in after a while. And it's one of the nicest Paddy's Day, modern Paddy's Day memories that I had. I often think of that boy on Paddy's Day every year. I was
he
like,
ended
Jesus.
Up with like $200.
Yeah, he probably, if
the biggest green glasses you've ever seen.
He probably went home with nothing but the glasses and the shorts. Isn't that some lift, though? Just going to the toilet. Imagine like the difference, that moment that he just had $5 measly in his pocket and there you go.
But I think that's what I like about Paddy's Day. Like it there's always so much joy around the place. Even like now, as I said now, like out in Swords where the parade is and even heading back into town is great. But I suppose from a food point of view, I think people, when they come here, they want to find things that are a little bit more traditional. So
of course.
We do a... we do a, for when the guests arrive on St. Patrick's Day, we're in the lobby, we open oysters with half a glass of Guinness, and if they want a pint of Guinness, of course, they can have a pint.
Nice.
And, you know, a proper lamb stew on the menu. And they're all the things that we move into.
Blanquette d'agneau.
Yeah, but eat like super classical. I don't mess around with it. Like, it's literally just a lamb stew. So it's, you know, shoulder that's diced, and then it's boiled.
It's boiled,
With some vegetables. Very, very simple. A little bit of barley in there, and then finish it with loads of chopped parsley. But and I like that type of thing. And I think when people come here,
love to eat that kind of stuff.
All of that food is so nourishing.
Yeah.
You know, kind of huggy food, if you like. So, I like to see all that type of stuff kicking around the menus at this time of year. And even when I was down in Australia, and like March is blading hot still, like, you know, you're going around the place looking for the blading bowl of stew. It's deadly.
Yeah.
It's deadly.
Yeah. Get the, whipping the coddle out, you know.
You just took the words out of my mouth. I was just saying, it'd be remiss of me not to speak about a coddle at this time, because it's another dish. It only goes on in Dublin, the coddle, I believe, does it?
Well, in Donegal, we call that studies. You know, my brother and I was never really...
It's made the same way, but sausages and...
It's pretty much made the same way, only instead of sausages, it's actually mince. It's pork mince that's boiled like a meatball, okay? And that'll get maybe a blanch in water first and then into the pot the second time. Same as a blanquette, same as a white lamb stew, really, or a proper Irish stew. You're always better to... do that first little blanch or boil in a separate
pot. Just sets the protein as well, right?
And it takes away the fatty sort of scumminess, I think. And then you get a nice clean blanquette, a nice clean stew on the second simmer. And but studies is something Pierce, my older brother, absolutely loved. Mammy would have made it for him. There's carrots, onions. Yeah.
There's carrots
and onions in it, maybe a little bit of white leek, possibly, maybe celery.
You're putting celery in there and white pepper.
It's white pepper. It's peppery, yeah. So white pepper and salt, and then it's boiled with like pork mince. Or actually, he might even use beef mince meatballs, but because it's boiled, it looks sort of white.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have been pork mince. It's beef mince boiled, and potatoes, obviously. And then sometimes they... You know, Mammy or Granny might have finished that with Bistol, but Pierce liked it as Judy's left blonde, left white. And that is so close to the Dublin version of coddle. So I suppose that's...
Well, I suppose the big thing with a Dublin coddle is that there's boiled sausages in it, which I think is what most of the country freaks. Ed Sheff is blading, rattling his head there. Like, he's not a fan.
Look at photographs of coddle.
Really?
It looks terrible.
It's dreadful.
Philly McMahon did it on the restaurant, but he wanted it as a starter. So he did. And I have to say, in the 12 or 13 years that I'm doing the show, I never put as much effort into anything. Stevie's a Kilbarrack boy as well. His mammy has her version of doing it. I went to the Holy Grail of coddle in Ireland. I went to Ciarán in the Gravediggers. And I asked him, and he was very kindly giving me his recipe. I was always disappointed in the show aired. They never give more time I've nothing to do with the edit, but I was devastated that there wasn't more emphasis made about the fact that it was Ciarán's recipe. So anybody that watched it, Ciarán and the Gravediggers gave me that recipe, and it was invaluable because, you know, bacon ribs. Yeah,
that's it, man.
There's bacon ribs.
Was that the trick?
So the reason, like, coddles can be made anyway, right? Everybody's house makes them different, but if you add bacon ribs into them, it's the bones to make the sauce a little bit more gelatinous. And then obviously buying super high quality sausages helps. Little things is what's going to get
the technique of the potatoes. Like, so the first batch of potatoes that goes in are actually going to break down. The starch is going to break down. That's going to have it that the texture of the coddle isn't totally watery. And then you're halfway...
It's like a very, very light potato soup.
It's a texture issue. When you look at the photographs or you see it in a bowl, I just see the boiled sausage.
I actually like the boiled sausages.
They taste amazing, but it's just the fact that
it's the visual.
We grew up eating them fried, that the boiled sausage...
I grew up eating them boiled in a blade and coddle, so I don't have that thing
about
it.
You also grew up eating fried sausages, surely.
Yeah, we did.
I'm with Ed on this one now, that it does not look great, but Ciarán's recipe had the bacon ribs as well. And it's all timing. But again, I go back to this thing, right, about simplicity, right? I mean, I'm good at nothing. Apart from cooking, which I've done a relatively good job at 30 years. That's right. Well, too. But for the most part, right, even hanging a picture in the house, right, I mean...
You must be really blading useless. Well, send out a couple of things.
I would wreck. Like, yeah, fucking
wreck
useless,
the gaff.
Actually. Yeah, I'd wreck the gaff. I probably would. I mean, and good for nothing. So I'm always very remiss to say something simple. And when you actually start building a good coddle and a dish that, in one sense, but the timing of the first wave of potatoes going in there, the bacon being soaked in water the day very before, important. Very important. The bacon going in early so that it has time to tenderize and cook. Then the sausages are going in. Then the potatoes that you're actually going to be breaking and are going to be whole that are in there and the onions. All the timing that goes into a good coddle. I'll tell you, man, I put a lot of attention into that dish and it was next level whenever we made it.
I've done it once in work. I've done a deconstructed number. So I made a...
Of course you'd ruin it.
And it did ruin...
5-star yeah, but you're not pricks. Honestly, yeah, yeah. Who do you think you are?
Well, come here.
How did you deconstruct the coddle? I can't wait to hear this.
Do you want to hear it? Mm. You sure? So we done... instead, the pork bit of it was a piece of roasted pork belly. And I set it on a little bed of really finely diced vegetables. And then the coddle bit of it, I made like a potato soup of velouté, right? A potato velouté. And then I blanched the bacon and I cooked the bacon and I cooked the sausages and I cut them into little battens and I folded.
So your mouth in there and Ed about boiled sausage and the first thing you did was use a pork belly, like you.
No, that's the first thing I did. I was like, you know what? I'll try and bring the world of coddle into a little bit finer.
Yeah.
Look, it was a nice dish. It was a roasted pork belly dish with a kind of very tasty bacony sausage sauce with it. But there was none of the look of that everybody freaks out over. It actually looked quite very, very elegant. But I'm still...
If I do say so, man.
Yeah, yeah, no, but I still like it the proper traditional way with bacon ribs. Honest to God, there's nothing better. And growing up, different friends would have it on different days. Like, and one friend in particular, his mom always made it on a Saturday. So, like, you'd knock around to his house and you could smell it walking.
Accidentally.
Yeah, yeah, you'd smell it. And she was walking, have a bowl of coddle. Yeah, no bother. Yeah. Straight. And she put bacon ribs in it. So.
Hey, I used to go around my auntie's house as well. Kate was to roast the chicken on a Friday. Granny always made a soup on a Wednesday. Out of my grandfather, Duncan, God rest him, used to call me the scarecrow. He said, you're the hungriest whore I ever seen. You know what I mean? I was sticks and bones too. Like, I didn't turn into a fat lad until I was in my 20s. You know what I mean? But I was there and I would just be like, oh, dinner's ready. Like, 11 o'clock. Oh, geez, you're having dinner. Because he went to the mart, so he used to have a dinner at 11 o'clock. My Auntie Kate always had her dinner at 1 o'clock. And then the old doll, my own house, had her dinner like around 4, kind of after school. I used to get 3 dinners a day. I used to time in the summers and holidays. I could move my way around all the different houses and nearly know what I was going to get as well. I loved it, you know.
Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Giving you a helping hand with your food frustrations.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us. Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Subscribe for free on the Go Loud app and never miss an episode.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
So I suppose the other thing, Gareth, that we wanted to talk about today is how the Irish food scene has been over the past few years and what big changes you've seen happen with it, or where do you think it's going? Do you think, like, there's an awful lot of talk at the, and there's, unfortunately, there is an awful lot of restaurants closing at the moment, because it's, you know, I know you spoke about it a few weeks ago on the radio there, but it's a tricky time to do business at the moment. There's a lot of rising costs and,
well, it really is. But before we kick off, I gotta say, old co-host, runner up 5-star hotel chef of the year last night.
Yeah.
Big Bula Bus for
great stuff.
Yeah,
our boy.
Thanks very much.
Really proud of you guys. I know from afar, well, not from afar, I know from being one of your best mates for a good while now, the graft that you've put into the marker over the last amount of years, 10 to 11 years, I'd say, it's open now at this stage. I always say this, you know, like that it's not easy to be a chef or a head chef in a fine dining restaurant, whatever. But now you go to hotels, you bring in room service, you bring in bar, all day dining, rooftop dining, banqueting, weddings, restaurant, sometimes two restaurants as well as the bar, 24-hour room service at 5-star level. And to be kicking it at the top table for as many years as you have is unbelievable, brother. Really well done on that there, you know. But going back to your point, it's a really worrying...
I'm blushing here for the record.
Yeah, yeah.
Can I contribute to say I'm editing all of that out?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No, Gareth.
It's too nice.
Absolutely.
You'll be waiting to hear it and it won't be there.
It'll ruin the vibe.
Yeah, it'll ruin the crack.
Yeah.
Gary, they'll think it's the sound. Now.
Yeah, exactly.
No, look... Do you know, 5 or 6 years ago, Radio 5 Live rang me, right? Don't ask me why, but they got in touch with me. I've been doing Saturday Kitchen a good few times around that period. And it was whenever Jamie Oliver lost his restaurants in the
Over.
UK, right?
Okay, yeah.
And I had also, you know, been around Arizona at that time, like doing a wee bit of work. And I'd seen the first time I'd ever seen a cloud kitchen. The guy that created Uber, I think, has also created the first cloud kitchens, which for anybody that doesn't know what that is, like, is basically just...
Shared space.
A huge building, and this one in particular was 35 different little kitchen units. No seats, no nothing, just literally 35 kitchens, which was 35 different restaurants under one roof, delivery only. And coupled with the fact that you're seeing the likes of Jamie Oliver fail and whatever, and I had said that I think over the next 10, 15 years, which is now bringing us right into the middle of that time, I think it's going to become really, really difficult for good cooks, good chefs, good restaurateurs to do business the way things are going. Landlords have got to the stage where property and rent and prices has just gone to a point where you're like, well, you catch yourselves on. We can't continue to spend this kind of money, as well as providing food at the highest level. Floor space just becoming so expensive. I know in France... In Paris, they have a lot more love for the people running the restaurants. There's caps on buildings and things like that. I don't know the exact details, but I do know that it's a lot more friendly towards, way more controlled.
Well, come here, over because there, sure, if you're bleeding, they went wrong over there. They just went and parked their bleeding buses on.
I know. But yeah, but the thing is as well, right, is they have a lot of respect for heritage. Yeah. They don't want to see, with all due respect to big chains like Starbucks and whatever, all of these big chains started as an independent at some stage, by the way. But let's be honest about it. You know, over the last couple of years or the last year and a half, I as you know, I did due diligence on a few places. Yeah. I'm obviously not going to say where. places that are trading better than they've ever traded, all losing money. Mm. And the banks aren't going to give people like me, even though you have some money, you've got an investor, you've got whatever, if the place isn't making money. So now when a place is closing, Gareth, there isn't a Gareth Mullins or a Gary O'Hanlon or a JP McMahon or a Kieran Glennon coming up behind them to reopen it and go again. Unless you've got the money now to drop $1 million on the building or 900,000 on the building or 600,000 on the building. Because banks are looking at me. I've done work for Bank of Ireland. I've done road shows for Bank of Ireland. I know people that look after that end. They want to support me. They want to give the likes of me or you money to do something. It's not there.
Well, it has to be commercially viable, right?
So well, the thing is, like the cost of sales now, like the cost of doing business has just gone so silly. And it's really sad. Like I think this year, 2024, is going to see a biblical amount of closures. You don't need to be.
But it's funny because some of the big chain restaurants, I mean, you use coffee shops as an example there. But I suppose the obvious big opening last year was Hawksmoor.
Yeah.
Hawksmoor. It's a good restaurant. I've eaten in it. I enjoyed it when I was in there.
Oh, well, the one in London's next level. It's the best steakhouse I've ever eaten.
It was very good. London. I wouldn't say it was the best steakhouse I've ever eaten in, but it was very good quality. It was really well sourced ingredients, cooked well. I mean, there was nothing mind blowing going on culinary wise, but it was all very solid. Mm. Walk into that restaurant on the bottom Dame Street and have a look up at the
scene. Yeah, they probably spent $1 million plus on it.
Millions spent on it. Like, that used to be the Abercrombie and Fitch store. And then before that, I think it was a bank. But the job they done on it, like, everything is like marble,
amazing.
Brass, leather. Beautiful, yeah. Like, it's beautiful restaurant. But someone small can't do that.
No.
Now, that restaurant, I'm sure at the start, like everyone else, is finding it very difficult to try it. I mean, so whoever's there, like the pockets are extremely deep, right,
yeah,
to get that up and running. But then there's like yourself that's having a look at a few bits and pieces, and you're looking at successful places that the banks are just going, I'm sorry, but that just doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know, like, we can't give you money to make that fail.
Yeah,
so, I think that's where this whole, I mean, like, the Ivy is here, it's been here for the last few years, you've got Hawksmoor. These big type of restaurants will come in because there is a gap within the market to feed people, right? And the smaller restaurants are backing off because they just can't make any money.
Mm.
But then, what I also think is super interesting, I think I spoke about it a few weeks ago, I ended up on Capel Street there a few Saturdays ago when we walked down Capel Street and had like a bowl of noodles, and it was cheap, but it was so delicious.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so delicious. And when you were in there was the local community of people were around there. You can see that they're all in there all the time. And it was an Asian restaurant, but it wasn't just all Asian people. It was all walks of life in there. And it really made me think, and I think I said it a few weeks ago, it made me think of my time of living in Australia, that you can get these very good value for money restaurants, but you're going to be sitting on a very cheap plastic chair. Your cutlery isn't going to be all that flash, right? So, you know, it's the polar opposite of what I just spoke about with the big. So I think it's a turbulent time for Irish food.
Mm.
I do think it's still a very exciting time for Irish food because we're very blessed to be involved with Eurotalk, I feel, and I mean that by saying that, because I get to see all the young emerging talent, and I get to see people compete in the competition, win the competition, don't win the competition, set up a restaurant, then they have fellas that are a little, and girls that are a little bit older that they can ask advice on. And I love the community around Irish food.
Yeah.
I think it's very solid.
It definitely is. And look, I also think the bounce back ability, I mean, you know, we've been through tough times, and Viewmount House opened literally the week that Lehman went kaput. I opened the 2nd of August 2008, and you couldn't get a seat in it for 9 months.
Right.
It was in the middle of Longford. Every man and his dog was saying, what are you going there for? What are you going there for? And I always said, I was like, you know what? If Nevin can bring people to the arsehole of Black Lion, and if you've never been to Black Lion, it's not the easiest place in the world to get to. And I took inspiration. I mean, me and him are great friends now. I didn't know him at the time. I just knew off him. But I'd always said, if it's good enough, they will come. That's a restaurant that, you know, I won Restaurant of the Year there. I was very, very proud of the place. And, you know, I think it's once that those places are still going to be built, they're still going to be furnished, and they're still going to be staffed, that young cooks, like, I was 29 when I went in there, I'm 45 now, but I was 29 whenever I went in there, full of beans, ready to go, a really, really young crew, and just balls to the wall cooking, and really supportive owners, and it was just amazing.
That is going on still. I mean, there's loads of good restaurants opening up, and when this comes out, there was 4 or 5 bibs awarded, new bibs. So that Michelin award, not only do they award Michelin stars, they also, in the book, they've recommended restaurants, and they've also got bibbed restaurants. And, a bibbed restaurant, you can't be over a certain price. I think
it used to be $40.
It's gone to 50, I think.
Yeah.
You have to be able to eat 3 courses for £50. So if you're someone that listens to this and you're wondering what it's like to, you know, venture into the world of what Michelin see, but you don't want to go straight out of the blocks and spend £500 on a meal for two
now,
people.
Between the two of us, can we name them all? So Amy Austin, opposite Brooks Hotel, got one. It's that wee place that looks like it's the door to the car park.
Yeah.
It's right on the corner. Dominique Kemp's got one there,
which is
Where's
Lottie?
Is that Ranelagh or?
I think it's up around there. I haven't actually been on
it. Yeah. I sent Dominique a message.
Yeah.
Who else got a bib? Oh, Solace down in Dingle.
That's right.
Got a bib. I actually thought they had one for a long time. Mm. So probably a tip of the hat to them. But there you go. They got a bib.
It was a Ford. But there was one more. I can't remember what the other one is. But I mean, it's very easy to find. And what I would say to you is, like, when I go to a city and I know Michelin is there, I'll always have a look at the bibbed restaurants.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you're not going to eat in a Michelin star restaurant every night.
Bibbed cooking is next level.
But what it really...
It's Michelin star dining on a budget.
It is, exactly. But what it is, they choose restaurants that are, like, super ingredients focused.
Yeah.
You know, that they're very approachable.
I was over the moon for Domini. I mean, she's been at the
brilliant.
Domini camp, right, has a vegetable soup. If you've never eaten the vegetable soup at It's a Bagel, do it.
Never had it.
I'm telling you now, right, I love going to Arnott's anyway, right? I think Arnott's is an institution. I just love browsing Briscoe's downstairs, the kitchen place. I mean, I know I'm a weirdo. I could look at cars, tractors, pots, pans, knives.
Blenders.
I could look at blenders, kettles, toasters, pans.
Coffee machines. You don't even drink coffee.
All day. And I don't even drink coffee yet. I could look at the Longy coffee makers thinking, geez, will Annette like me tonight if I buy her this? Do you know what I mean? All day long. And just amazing. But there's a wee... It's a... There, as you go in one of the doors, I don't know what the street is, but one of them doors you go in,
Liffey Street.
It's a Bagel is right there at the entrance to Arnott's, and when the veg soup is on, she's red lentils in it, carrots cut on the bias,
delicious.
big chunks of carrots, it's too big.
It's like a minestrone type of thing, is that or not?
The key is you get the soup, put two little sachets of black pepper into it. Mm. It's one sachet too much, so. They'll be given out and a cold can of Coke and sit there and watch the world go by.
Good.
You're welcome.
That's, yeah.
Unbelievable.
That's the juice right
there. Cold can of Coke, giddy up. I literally only go there for the soup sometimes. And you know, that's the beauty of food, right? I mean, you could pick a load of different, you know, a load of different dishes, like the shepherd's pie and the pig's ear, like a slow cooked lamb. Stevie does a shepherd's pie in there. Unbelievable. You know what I mean? I always love going into the marker for a wee sneaky steak before the Bourgogne.
Right.
I mean, I have a 10-year-old now and she's like, not only does she get to go to the Bourgogne for shows, but she has to be brought in for the Gareth's for something to eat first. You know what I mean? And
well, don't worry, because her elf just pulls up to the front of the hotel and she's bleeding Owens and then travels his keys to concierge.
That's why I drive a nice car. You know? They don't mind it being parked there.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so now it's over to Ed Sheff for one of our favourite parts of the show, the culinary conundrums.
What my favourite part has been called Ed Sheff, straight up.
I love him, man.
I'm set for life.
I hope your wife calls you Chef now, does she?
Easy now, fiancé.
Oh, easy.
We're still in regulation time. Hasn't gone too far yet. Hello, Gary and Gareth. Imelda from Dundalk here, love the pod. I'm a bit of a film fanatic and I've always wanted to ask a chef what their favourite chefing film is, and also what do films and TV shows get wrong when they're showing how a kitchen works? Cheers. That's a good question.
Well, I absolutely loved Chef, the actual movie called Chef, Jon Favreau,
yep.
And Roy Choi. Roy Choi had pretty much the very first ever food truck. In fact, they've now put that actual food truck in a hotel in Vegas.
Yeah.
But Roy
Choi, hard to watch on Netflix. He was the first one to do it, that series of...
I think there's a series based on the movie now as well.
Yeah.
But Roy Choi's based out of LA, kind of got well-known. Jon Favreau, who's an unbelievable actor and director, producer as well, but really into his food apparently, and he was a big fan of Roy Choi, and they literally came up, because even the cooking and the manoeuvring and the mannerisms.
He
and
teaches
that.
Him, but doesn't he? Isn't that the show?
He was a consultant on the movie as well. But I just thought that Jon Favreau was unbelievable. I thought Bradley Cooper did a brilliant job as well on, what was that one called? I know Marco
was a
consultant on that, and Ramsay. Yeah.
Boiling Point.
I'll look it up.
I didn't like that. The one Stephen Graham was in, I thought Boiling Point was shite. That got a lot of good reviews.
The show that I think is very, very, very close to what's going on now, it's not a movie, but it's Bear.
Yeah.
Yeah, I meant to ask, what was your take on... Sorry, the name of that film is Burnt.
Burnt, oh yeah. Yeah. I really like Burnt, yeah, but...
Bear is very, very close to
I stopped
what
watching Bear after two or three episodes, but that's me though.
But the movement in it and like...
Oh yeah.
Even...
The tension.
Yeah, but you know, when it goes back to his career where he studied and memory goes to that really... That's based on an actual restaurant called right. 11, right? Okay. Which it ended up getting its third star. Because I know by the look of it, I've seen books and all of that restaurant and I follow a man on Instagram, but you can see that... They went there and, you know, but the movement of the chefs around the place, it's very, very realistic. So
yeah,
people that consulted on that forum,
Yeah, and we're good. Yeah, I kind of want to watch all that with Nettie. Like, we have this thing at night, Tim and the kids go to bed. I go to my office out of her way. We're in the two opposite ends of the house.
Hold on there. Hey, Jeff, hold on here. This could go anywhere.
We keep our marriage strong by staying as far apart as we possibly can.
You're down there googling blenders and tractors.
Yeah, I'm getting all hot and sweaty over a toaster, and she wants to watch Emily in Paris, and I'm not having it. So I'm on the
clap shows. Could be watching Blade Man, you know.
I know, I'm on the cop shows and she's on the more elegant lady-like stuff, you know what I mean? But Chef was brilliant. I loved Burnt. I thought Boiling Point put too much emphasis on drugs and pressure and death stereotypical chefy stuff. I have recorded the BBC series that just followed it. They did a six-parter called Boiling Point as well. Used the same cast, I think. And I have it in the Skybox to go to it, but I'm not being drawn to it just yet, you know, but Chef, unbelievable.
And I suppose when you're looking at that like that from a professional point of view, you'll see little things that aren't right or that wouldn't happen. But I think now, because they're bringing chefs in as consultants and all of these things, like all these things are so heavily produced now, that they're bringing real pros and they'll just go, but no one is ever going to chop a carrot.
Did you
like
Raw when it was on RT? Did you ever watch the Irish
show?
Never watched
it. No.
Jesus, a lot. Raw, Annette Good. And I, it was unbelievable, yeah. There's another show in the UK that only got one season, right? But there's an actor, I sort of started doing TV around this time and I had this wee running joke with Annette. She'll laugh now because she listens to this, right? But there was a character in it called Scoose. I have to look up the name of this place, right? But the lead actor has hair, curly hair like Marco. He's a famous comedian over there.
Based on Marco, would you say?
No, they didn't make him cut his hair anyway. It was more upbeat in comedy. The sous chef was this big tall dude, super funny. But there was a third character and his name was Scoose. And every now and again he'd be giving like this wee look. It was like this wee look to camera. And it was so funny. But I would be doing way, way back, Late Lunch Live, the afternoon show, which became the Today Show. But I used to Scoose the camera, messing like... I go
home Sony,
and
I get in the car the nose.
And Annette would write, "Scoose, you did Scoose." I was like, "I did that for you, Nanny. I did that for you."
Nice.
The little things, Cara.
Yeah. Just things. Entertaining myself, you know.
Good man.
Right, on to the next one. Hi, guys. I have two questions, if that's okay. Yes, it is. Can you recommend a technique for maintaining moisture in poultry? All right. And what's one advanced cooking technique you think is worth learning? Cheers, Katie Lucy in Limerick City. So the first one is for maintaining moisture.
Keeping poultry moist, it's brine is number one. So a brine is, I feel like I talked about brining not that long ago, but in essence, anything that has a bone in it, in particular poultry, if you're like roasting a whole chicken, they do say that you should always brine anything like that. So it's basically a solution where it's almost 10 times water to like one part salt sugar solution, and you'd have some dry spices in there as well, some peppercorns, maybe star anise, a cinnamon pod, any kind of aromatic, some bay leaves in it, and you basically bring that up to the boiler. You boil it for enough that the sugar and all dissolves, let it go completely cold. So you would need obviously a large container for this, and then you place your chicken into it. And say you're roasting the chicken today, you'd put it into the brine yesterday, take it out, pat it dry, season it as you normally would and cook it. And that is a technique that draws moisture into the meat, okay? And that is brilliant. If you don't use a brine, buttermilk is amazing on poultry as well. It really, like a buttermilk brined chicken is the nicest thing.
You gave a recipe a couple of episodes.
I feel like I talked about it not that long ago.
But also really... If the poultry is going dry,
you're cooking it too long.
You're just overcooking. Straight up. What I would say is, you need to get yourself a meat thermometer, because that just is what fixes it, right? So, and the magic number for a meat thermometer is 75 degrees. People may have seen it. I done a campaign for Safe Food this year. I actually done it last year as well, but it's just about cooking chicken and poultry in particular to 75 degrees, and then it's perfectly safe to eat. But also, it's cooked. I think the mistake that people make is to go, I'll give it another 50.
They cook it to 90.
Okay.
They cook it past even 90. Do you know what I mean? They cook the blade and bejesus over. And then when you cook something so aggressively like that, when you take it out of the oven and you let it rest, all the juices run out of the bird and then you're left with this really dry, stringy.
And because poultry is so lean anyways as a starting point, there's just no fat there to carry moisture, you know? So you're cooking... has to be spot on timing-wise, you know. Yeah. And the second part of that then was a cooking technique.
An advanced cooking technique.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know whether we can call it advanced. Like, when you learn to be a chef, and I don't know whether I've ever spoken about this before, but you learn the principles of cookery. You don't learn the recipe.
Okay.
And I think that's the other thing that most people don't understand. Like, they learn a recipe and they go, they nail on how to do a beef and Guinness pie, say. And I'll be like, all right, well, then you know how to braise. No, I don't. Well, you do, because that's what you just did. You've seared off the meat, you've added in the beer or the liquor, and then you've put it into the oven and you've cooked it really slowly.
So it's like a teach them how to fish thing.
Exactly. Yeah. So I would always say, you know, like, if you're only, most people at home are roasting and they're pan frying, there's probably the two realms that most people live in. I would say, if you want to just learn one more thing, I would say bring steam into your cookery. And the best way to do that is get yourself into an Asian supermarket and buy yourself a little bamboo steamer. I shared a recipe there a couple of weeks ago. It was a good few weeks ago now on Pakenny for a steamed...
sea bass.
Thank you, Gary. Yeah. Steamed sea bass dish, thanks. but it's a really delicate way of eating something. So if you go and you buy a really fresh sea bass fillet, it is lovely roasted on the pan, or it's lovely cooked up hoppy. Yeah, Gary gave a cool recipe a few weeks ago for cooking in an envelope. But if you just gently steam that and you introduce a few little Asian flavours, so, you know, soya sauce, a little bit of sesame oil, maybe a little bit of mirin, and then some grated ginger and grated garlic, and you just dress that very gently steamed piece of fish, then you're moving into the world of what's going on in restaurants. We're trying to not manipulate things too much and just cook them with real precision. And they're cheap as chips. I think you get a steaming basket for, I think they're about 10 quid. But what I would say to you is, if it's a family of two, buy the 6-inch one. If you're a family of four, buy the 8 or the 10-inch one. And buy one lid, but buy two steamer baskets. So if you were doing the sea bass, you could put like cabbage or bok choy or maybe some greens on the bottom, and then you sit your next lid on top with your fish on it, and then you just pop it on the wok with a little bit of water in the end. And it takes like 6 or 8 minutes. Wow. And it'll be perfectly cooked. And it'll be a very delicate new technique to learn, and then once you learn it, then you can start moving into the world of steam and all other things. So
great. Third letter comes in from Philip in on letter sorry who am I email. Philip in Athlone, I am retiring this year after 40 years of teaching. Fair play, Phil. No. It has always been my dream to do a foodie holiday. Is there any countries or regions you'd recommend? I'm thinking of Italy or France, of course, but is there any places off the beaten path that you've been to that you'd recommend? Thanks in advance, Philip in Athlone.
Yeah, well, look, in one episode, if you go back into the episodes, I kind of spoke extensively about Lisbon, so it's worth going back and listening there. So I won't hash over that again. That's brilliant. What I will say is, as a young, cocky chef, like most of us are, I probably didn't give Italian food or Italy enough credit for just how amazing the place is, right? So you pick any part of Italy or any region of Italy and go to it. They've got different types of cuisine from north to south, like, so for, and then the middle in Rome and what have you. But one thing that is uniform across it is the ingredients in that country will blow your mind. The simplest of stuff. I stayed in a hotel in Positano a few years ago. I went down, got a loaf of bread, tomatoes, I'll remember to the day I die, right? These tomatoes, basil. I bought this artichoke crema, and then I got a couple of like Sorrento lemons, like unwaxed straight from the tree lemons, and a few other wee bits and pieces, caper flowers and all sorts. And the hotel we were in didn't do breakfast. It was just rooms or whatever, but you had a lovely table and a fridge and everything in your room. And I stocked it with a few wee bits and pieces. I don't think I ate as well as I did for the 4 or 5 days I was there in the morning.
I got married in Italy. Married in Tuscany, in Siena.
Yeah.
We had 80 guests or 100 guests over for 3 days or 4 days. And I would, everything that Gary said. But if you're only getting into the world of like really wanting to travel with food, I would start off with the big cities if you haven't done them. So I'd look at Barcelona, Madrid, Lisbon, Bilbao, even if you really want to get into the world of food. But do a city break there, because it'll really get you going into what they do in all these places is tapas so well. And I know Gary spoke a few weeks about going to the one in Lisbon.
Yeah.
And
time out market. And
there's one of them. There's one of them in Barcelona. There's one of them in Madrid. And if you're with somebody, then you go right. You go left. I go right. Get one. You get a meat dish, I'll get a fish dish, and you buy a drink, and I'll buy a drink.
Yeah.
So one of you bring back a beer, the other one brings back a glass of wine.
Yeah.
You eat them and go, right, go again, get something vegetarian.
It's an unbelievable way.
I'll throw in San Sebastian in there.
Come on.
Unbelievable.
Ed Sheff with the shout of the season.
Yeah.
I just thought I'd put it to bed. What are you on about?
Yeah, you're right.
San Sebastian was one of the best few days I had in my life.
Do you know, I haven't been yet.
Make sure you bring plenty of your retirement money to San Sebastian.
Yeah. It's worth it, though.
It's saucy.
Yeah, keep them coming in, please, on food@goloudnow.com.
All right, Gareth, that wraps up another episode of Dishing It Out. Make sure you guys spread the word. We're trying to build an audience. It's going good so far. Like, follow, subscribe, whatever it is that you're meant to say, wherever you listen to your pods. Even if you tell one person today about the pod, it'll help give the boys a wee booster. That was a good one. You know, it's nice to not have anybody else in the studio sometimes. Just listen to your dulcet Dublin tone.
You love it, man.
I can listen to you all day, man, dear.
Same to you, my friend.
And Ed Sheff jumping in every now and again.
San Sebastian made us look like
amateurs with that one.
Talk about a mic drop. Have you boys ever heard of
that? When you listen to this podcast, it'll just be that bit.
I know the clip is going to be for this one.
I was just about to go to London, and then Ed was like, all right, well, that's my deal. Between my legs.
Sent packing
by Ed Sheff. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Subscribe for free on the Go Loud app and never miss an episode.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.